folks have forgotten their own childhoods.
This vital record is not available to them as an experience. It is subverted too much. Or then we simply try to go across the interval, reasoning with them from our own adult position and achieving practically no good. To reach them, we must reach back in ourselves to these children in ourselves. Immediately, the mental barrier is crossed, and we become alike. That which is alike can never be completely separated. Now, in the Buddhist doctrine, the bodhisattvic concept of compassion is the immediate remembrance of the experiences of being through which the enlightened creature has passed, and which therefore it can revitalize through meditation, and can relive all that is less than itself, because it has been all that is less than itself. It does not relive only the surface of its achievement, but all the way back through the degrees of its attainment. Thus, the bodhisattvic compassion represents the ability of the individual or the being to re-experience the need of all creatures. And in the Buddhist doctrine, the bodhisattva Kuan Yin is the one experiencing the great soul need, the great soul hunger of all things that live. And experiencing that great soul hunger speaks to the disciple, to the student, to those who would serve. Feed my sheep. In other words, supply this hunger. Out of attainment, supply this need. So love experiences the world as need in the element or quality of compassion. This need is without boundary, without limit. Human and practical values may not permit the other to be boundless in his fulfillment of his instinct. But it makes this instinct transcend species, races, nations, types, creeds, religions, beliefs, anything of that kind, and to recognize the great hunger of life, as Bailey called it, the great hunger, that everything that is imperfect is hungry, terribly hungry. It is hungry for peace. It is hungry for love. It is hungry for growth, for understanding, for wisdom. But most of all, it is simply hungry and does not know what type of food or nourishment it requires. So as man experiences creatures evolving in life around him, he sees this great hunger. And then as he turns and experiences the abundance of the divine love, he sees the great nourishment, the tremendous nutrition that is available, and the great problem of bringing food to the hungry, bringing life to those who need it. This becomes the great a work of love, the great work of sincere admiration and adoration in nature. In the yoga processes, the individual enters into meditational associations with these powers or qualities of which he seeks to attain. And in this discipline, one of the things that he is expected to achieve is the discovery of the universal in all things. He is supposed to be able gradually to become aware of an infinite life, an infinite identity of consciousness in all the forms and creatures of life. Thus we can say that in his meditation, let us say for the moment that he takes a flower, a rose, and we remember Dante, who was of such a strongly mystical nature that he could not look at an open rose without weeping and becoming almost hysterical. The sheer beauty of it moved in upon him with such a tremendous impact that it seemed to shatter his whole existence. He was overwhelmed by the release of the divine through the magnificence of this flower. So in taking any object, a flower or anything else, the individual seeks to find in it or to experience through it the divine light that is forever present in it and manifesting in its growth. You can analyze the flower forever, but you will not find this. But it can be experienced by an immediate impact of consciousness. Suddenly, this impact strikes you, shattering entirely the integration of thought, practically removing the power of the individual to interpret that which he receives as impact. He simply knows. He simply intuitively accepts the divine release through the symbol. And he comes to recognize all forms and all bodies and all structures in nature as merely symbols of divine love. Symbols of universal beauty, harmony, peace, wisdom, all in one, releasing themselves forever to those who have the sensitivity, the internal consciousness, to accept the impact of these symbols. Now it is obvious that the flower does not change, and it's obvious that these symbols remain as they are, flesh and bone, stone, wood, paint, marble. Therefore, the actual release is within the person himself. It is the release of his own love which causes him to find love in everything else. It is the release of his own divinity, forever reflected back to him from the forms around him in nature. It is then evident that he can never find these reflections, never experience them, unless he releases himself. But no matter how much he penetrates the symbol, he will never find the meaning. For the meaning is in him and not in the symbol. Under such realization and under such consideration, it becomes entirely necessary that the person refine and release his own internal potential of universal veneration or adoration. Until he achieves this, he cannot experience it in anything else. If then, he must make this achievement within himself, how does he do it? He does it by bringing numerous factors of life together. In India, for example, the boy, young man, who is going to take up the study of yoga, finds himself, or is appointed, a teacher. Now, this teacher may be any elderly character, venerable appearance, and perhaps of wide reputation, who is known to be advanced in these matters. The boy first experiences his disciplines of yoga in his attitude toward this old man. The teacher is not a god. The boy perfectly well knows that. But the teacher is the custodian of a doctrine that is old, venerated, regarded, traditionally rich. This teacher is the keeper of the great culture of his race. The attitude toward the teacher then becomes the beginning of the experience and discipline. the boy's simple acceptance of the teacher, his natural respect for the teacher, his perfect willingness to follow according to the instruction of the teacher, his simple delight at doing well and receiving the applause of the teacher, his simple patience under the correction of the teacher. All of these things are parts of the beginning of the discipline. For little by little, the lad learns where values lie, and who is the teacher, and what is important in life. Now, the teacher isn't present much in the Western world, very seldom. So we have nature, life itself, as the teacher. If we do not venerate the teacher, we will never understand the teaching. Therefore, if we do not develop a simple, direct, gentle obedience to the laws governing life, if we do not accept the lessons of the day as bearing witness to the love of God, if we are not patient under the adversities of the time, recognizing them as good, not bad, until we achieve these levels, we are like the young Hindu lad who has not yet learned how to work with his teacher. Because that whether it be the person or the world that teaches us, both are gurus and both are to be regarded, respected, and revered. So we have life as our teacher. Life which we must learn to love, not to be fooled by it, not to be deceived by it, but to recognize it for what it is. That we are supposed to live it, that we are supposed to meet it, make decisions, and that in daily conduct we are to live wisely, moderately, lovingly, constructively. Thus we obey. Thus we venerate this great pattern itself. And so finally we can look out upon life and say, it is good. And when we honestly and truly mean that, we find several interesting things happen. First of all, life is not nearly as difficult as it was. I've heard many people say, and I've been asked myself, how an individual could keep on loving and accepting forever the misfortunes that he has to carry. The answer is, as soon as he starts loving and understanding, the misfortunes cease. They do not go on forever, because these misfortunes are the result of man's resistance to truth. They are not due to the presence of evil, but to the absence of wisdom and understanding in his own nature. Thus, the obedience to the teacher, the obedience to life, the acceptance of the laws governing life, all these result in a non-combative attitude toward life. Now in the West, we say an individual who is non-combative is dead. We think that unless a person is out shadow boxing inevitable all the time, he's a failure. He hasn't got anything. He lacks aggressiveness. He lacks that spark, that punch that is going to make him sell more fuller brushes than any other man in the community. But in the East, the primary consideration is not selling fuller brushes. And the individual learns that if he relaxes his own intemperances toward life, the shadows of adversity by which he is apparently surrounded begin to clear. And that just as eternal love, once found in himself, is then observed as everywhere present, so eternal discord, while it continues in the self, will be seen in everything else. By going out of conflict with the patterns of being, the individual begins to find his own difficulties falling away. He finds that it is easier and easier to adjust. There is the conflict between personal will and universal will. As long as the individual is going to change the universe at all costs, He is going to be changed by the universe at all costs. But when he begins to adjust to laws, he begins to experience the beauty of them. He finds no conflict in laws he obeys. He finds no evil, no hate, no destruction in the laws he keeps, only in the laws he tries to break. So by degrees, through obedience, he experiences a lawful creation. And in experiencing a lawful creation, he also begins to apperceive that these laws are themselves the very substance of a divine regard, that actually law and love are one, that they are not even polarities of each other, they are one entity, one being in space. For having discovered the goodness of law, we naturally love that which is good. And having discovered the legality of the world, we perceive also its lovability, that it is something that we cannot do, that can never fail us, and that is the cause of endless admiration. Thus the young disciple, having adjusted to the disciplines of his school, which are the disciplines of living, begins to go on under the guidance of his teacher. And as he goes on, more particular and specific problems are presented to him. Problems which at first he did not even know existed. The same happened in the school of life. When we have broken through the outer crust of error or illusion, and have begun to go forward toward a greater enlightenment, then we begin to experience larger and more amazing patterns of requirements. We see that all these patterns challenge us. They present to us descriptions, forms, and symbols, inviting us to proceed, inviting us to obey still more perfect laws, still more complete patterns or archetypes. And these become the bases of specific disciplines. Laws, rules, patterns, abiding forever in space. As the disciple continues on with these experiences, there is a sublimation inevitably in his nature. But I feel that here in the West, this problem of sublimation must be very carefully handled. The West is not aesthetic by nature. We are persons long grounded in objectivity. Our world is a visible world. Our problems are immediate and tangible. Also, our relationships with others are very much objective. And yet, we have many religious movements here in the Western world, and to some degree this is true in the East. There is a tendency always to depart from the profane and hasten toward the sacred. This is bad yoga, regardless of how it may be deified by term or poem or sutra. Actually, man never moves from the profane to the sacred. Because these are conditions of one thing. A child is not the polar opposite of a man. Nor does man by will move from being a child to being an adult. It is a condition of growth. The child in the man never dies. It is matured. It expands. It extends. It releases more and more of its own potential. But the child is not divorced from the man, but transformed into the man. If we cast off our lower emotions, so-called, and try to throw them into limbo, we cannot get rid of them. It's a peculiar thing. When we throw our lower emotions away, we have to throw ourselves with them, because there is no separation. Thus, the individual is forever trying to get rid of the lower and rush on to the higher, is assuming the existence of two things where only one exists. Thus, the person cannot be in the situation, legitimately, of being better than he wants to be. And that is something that is quite common in our modern religious experience. The individual who is just too good to do what he feels like doing. The individual, I remember one, who decided that he, for his spiritual salvation, was going to refrain from certain types of food. He was working along that line rather assiduously. He wouldn't eat hotcakes. They were too starchy. And besides that, the maple sugar was too rich and might damage some of the gentle and subtle parts of his etheric double, or something of that nature. He was too wise, too noble, too wonderful to eat them. But not too wise, too noble, or too wonderful to stand in front of Child's Restaurant while they were making the hotcakes in the window and drooling by the hour. This is a point we'd like to try to clarify. He was an individual trying desperately to be better than he was. If he wanted them that badly, he should have eaten them, because in his internal life, he had already eaten hundreds of them. In some way, he simply lacked the courage to go in and order them. And he believed that he was really making a heroic spiritual sacrifice. It was a sacrifice of some kind, but it wasn't spiritual. Now, the individual who is desperately afraid that he's going to leave a lot of human happiness behind on his way to divine bliss is really not in any emergency, even though he may think that he is. The way of growth is not along a path of regrets. Growth is a perfectly natural unfoldment of emotions, by which these changes are as subtle as the growth of a child. From day to day, there is no shock. The individual finds that his interests, his inclinations, his tastes, his attitudes, everything gradually develops until he continues to express his affections always in the simplest and most natural way to himself. And until that condition is achieved, there is no essential emotional progress. Up to that time, he's only fooling himself. He is never in the position where, wishing to be kind, he must bite his lip for fear he will not be. Or having the desire to say the unpleasant word that he must grind his teeth to keep his spirituality intact. These things cannot exist. That is a delusion that we have in the West that has done much to make spiritual growth seem almost a penalty upon life, a horrible thing, a terrible sacrifice in which we should all gain martyr's crowns merely from the fact we try. This is not the way it is. There's no resemblance to it. These things grow. Affection grows, qualities of affection refine, emotions become transmuted by a gradual process. But always the individual in a completely relaxed condition and without trying to be better than or worse than he is, should express the level of his own attainment, and will do so. He need not fight it, he need not defend it. It simply expresses. And until it does so, it is not attained. But through living and through thoughtfulness, through understanding, through the rich desire of the spirit to grow, these procedures become natural, easy, reasonable, happy. And the person moves on from an intense addiction to physical things to a greater recognition of the qualities in things. This happens where persons who have been happily married over a period of years watch the changes taking place within their own natures and in the nature of their partners without being particularly upset. It is quite possible, for example, that looking back upon the years, the woman would not have married 20 years before the husband she did marry if he looked as then as he does now. She would say, he is too old, he is no longer pleasant, he is putting on a little weight, the hair is getting a little thin, there's a little sag around the corner of the mouth. 20 years ago, did he look like that? She wouldn't have married him. But today, she doesn't even notice that he looks like this. He has grown older with him. They have grown up together. Gradually, the tremendous importance of exteriors has given way to the camaraderie of character, to the deepening of understanding, the strengthening of the bonds of interests. And this person, older today, is more handsome, more wonderful than they were before, because new values have come into existence. And it's the same thing in the affections of the human being towards nature, toward the universe, and toward God. These things unfold. We would no longer be satisfied with the adolescent standards we started with, and we should not be. We would be no longer desirous of possessing. We have long reached the joy of releasing. There is no struggle. We're not giving up something we want to hold on to. Once we wanted to hold, so we held. Now we wish to release, so we release. And both of these are equally joyous occasions, if we have grown. So all the conflict and struggle to be good, and to try to love something we don't like, these things disappear in the growth of consciousness, in the unfoldment of the conscious nature within us. And we go on toward that larger recognition of our own ultimates. In youth, you're ambitious. You want to be somebody. As we get a little older, we're not quite so sure we're ever going to be somebody. As we get still older, we pray that we may be delivered from being. And figure that if we can just have that little farm out in the country somewhere, we're going to be perfectly contented to settle for that, even though in early life we have been craving millions, position, authority, all these things. We have grown in our movement. Now in our loves, we have also this growing. The adolescent, the savage, the primitive human being, loving God, loves the power of God and tries to draw it to himself for his own use. The mature human being rather recognizes the grace of God and hopes that he may be able to accept that grace and share in it and give himself to that grace rather than to demand or require. Also, there comes a time in the evolution of the human being when he gradually becomes more and more suspicious of his own ego. The young person is not. The young person is always right anyway. It takes him a long time to realize that he isn't right in many things. But the young person believes in himself. As we grow older, we're not quite so sure of ourselves. When we were 20, we were always right. When we are 40, we are sometimes right. And by the time we are 60, we are seldom right. And we're not awfully unhappy over the discovery. Because actually, with these maturities have come also other values that make it less desirable that we should always be right. So we take it in stride. So in the young spirit growing up, is tremendously concerned with itself. The personal pronoun simply dominates every other consideration. And for this vertical pronoun, the individual is willing to give and sacrifice everything else. Gradually, as he proceeds along the path of evolution, he begins to doubt this personal self. This self which he loved to think of as first mortal, then immortal. Mortal while he went to college, immortal after he gets out of college. And so he goes. But as he goes in understanding within himself begins to realize that perhaps this self that he has been so addicted to is really a larger problem than it is worth. That instead of being the source of his power, it is the cause of his difficulty. So when he proceeds gradually along the mystical path as recognized in the ancient systems, he begins to realize that this self is an eternal limitation, that it causes him always to stand somewhere and look something over. He stands off and he says, I like that, I don't like that. Or he stands over somewhere else and he tries to analyze this and he tries to analyze that. And he goes so far as to stand there and try to figure out God. And he begins to try to contemplate what God is like. He examines God as he can find it in his works. Adds this up, subtracts that, considers this, weighs that, looks for the latest findings, compares them with the first findings, and in the end, is an observer of phenomena. He's never broken through it. And as he goes along doing this, he comes finally to the realization that he is never going to find God. Because as long as he is separate from God and can estimate God, he will never experience God. So in the yogas, we have this point that is so controversial in Western philosophy. Namely, the final transition from self to universal. And this comes in our experience of love. A very simple example of that is the parent, the father or mother, who in an emergency will usually sacrifice a life for the child. If there must be one that will go on, the parent will give his for his child if he loves that child. And he does not regard it as a sacrifice. It may be so labeled by others who come after him who will refer to his nobility and so on. But to him, it was instinct. It was the inevitable that this child was some way, something that had to go on. And if one had to perish, the parent would die for the child. We have the same in larger political patterns. The hero who dies for his country. Not one who has been forced to by draft law, but one who actually goes out and puts the good of his country above himself and willingly sacrifices himself for it. What has he done? He has done the biggest thing he knows how to do because he has destroyed voluntarily the most important thing he knows, self. Perhaps he believes in immortality, but doesn't know it. He cannot. He can only believe it. Therefore, he has taken a supreme chance of passing into a state of non-existence. He has sacrificed the symbol of his selfhood in order to protect the selfhood in something else. This is the biggest thing he knows how to do, and it becomes a symbol of something he's done later. It becomes ultimately the symbol of the great love that man can know. And that is the love which is the voluntary sacrifice of self to the beloved. The beloved in this case is truth, reality, God. To which the voluntary sacrifice is no longer something that was a great pain, something that required tremendous decision, but the next and inevitable impulse of reunion or identification with the beloved. A man discovers that as he approaches the mystery of universal love, he approaches with it the mystery of universal wisdom and universal life, and they are one. Therefore, there comes the time in the disciplines when there is only one great emotion left in him as an individual. And that is the tremendous longing to be one with the eternal. This is found in the Dervish poems of Prasadi and many of them, Jani and many of the others. It is this tremendous willingness, this eagerness to cease forever in the beloved. And in the Bhakti Yoga, we come in the disciplines ultimately to this point, that it is not a desperate desire for truth that lures us on. It is not a determination to solve the mystery even if we have to die to do it. It is not any pressure from within ourselves at all of that nature. It is an infinite longing to be one again with totality. To return as the drop of water to the shining sea. To be one once more with that which has been the end of seeking and the end of hoping and the end of loving. That the individual shall no longer love, but that the individual shall be love itself. And become one and complete with this tremendous moving power of the world. So in this complete spaces found in the practice of yoga, the individual experiences temporarily the imminence of love, finding it an immense and intangible sensitivity, infinitely tender, infinitely strong, so that there is only the one tremendous desire, and that is to be one with it, to be united with it forever. In an eternal relation, an eternal reunion or yoga with this tremendous power. Now, how does the mystic interpreting this, how does he define this experience of love? Does he explain it or define it in human emotions at all? No. It has gone far beyond that by the time he is capable of even experiencing the shadow of infinite. It has gone to the point where to him love is an entirely different thing from what we know. Love is an infinite sharing. It is an infinite giving of self forever. It is the divine power moving forever towards a not-selfness. It is the divine that is divine because it forever is. And in this, the mystic experiences eternal or divine love as the ever-bestowing. That which is ever-giving and never-demanding. And therefore, that which, because it never demands, receives all. And because it gives forever, possesses all. So this is the great contrast, what it is like to want on the material plane. What we hold, we lose. What we give, we keep. Therefore, the perfect love which holds nothing and gives all, actually holds all, as everything returns to it again, by the very process of its own eternal unselfishness. And in this law also, the mystic experiences the infinite experience of absolute security. Not personal security, not that the individual is now safe forever, but the condition or state of an eternal security to which there can never be a deficiency, to which there can never be a condition. The state of absolute faith. Transformed from our term of faith to the faith of utter knowing. Also the experience of absolute good, and that this absolute good is the end of all seeking after good, and all paths and all roads lead finally to the heart of truth. And the heart of truth is this power which ever protects, ever guards, ever preserves, and yet never occupies an aggressive relation to anything that exists. Everything that seeks it must flow into it, and in flowing into it, returns to the sovereignty of its own self. Thus man, as a creature as he knows himself, is a condition of this, is a mood of it, as possessing a temporary passing form of it, whereas this eternal power itself is the complete and unchanging continuity of absolute love. The mystic approaching it is filled with a sudden and complete realization of the heart of God. The recognition that as the laws of God are infinite, so is the heart. That the mind of God is all-pervading, so is the heart. But that as in man, the mind is only justifying the heart, so in God, the wisdom of God is only justifying the love of God. This is a very important mystical point. It may take a little time for it to be clearly assimilated into consciousness. But the divine wisdom sustains the divine love. For the great sun, the great central light of the universe, according to Bhakti Yoga, is God as infinite love. Infinite wisdom protects, manifests love. Infinite law reveals love. Infinite truth leads to love, or states love forever. But all these are the manifestations of the one thing itself, which is infinite, timeless, eternal regard, a complete and mysterious devotion that extends throughout space to the end of time. And in this mystical apperception, the individual experiencing or coming closer to it, comes toward the heart of reality, and finds the greatest dream and hope of his life and consciousness fulfilled in that tremendous moment in which, as a being, he is absorbed in the love of God. This is his natural, conceivable end. And beyond that, he does not even care to go. He does not know. But the life which begins in pain ends in his love. And he visualizes existence as the cycle of love to love, through truth and wisdom and law. And in this pattern, he has an inward meditation, a meditation of the continual remembering of this, of the visualizing it, and as it arises in his consciousness, opening his eyes and beholding it shining in the world around. Until light and life and power, until the earth and the sun and the moon, the stars, the flowers, the creatures are all radiant with this tremendous eternal power, then the universe is in order. Doubts and fears cease. And the mystic, happily and gloriously, seeks final union with the beloved, finding in that union the end of waiting, the end of all doubt and fear. In the beginning of a life beyond conception, something he knows nothing of, and admits it immediately, but does not need to know, because what do we need to know about the beloved except that which is told to us by our own hearts? Do we question our love? Do we question that which is the substance of our desire? Do we ask the beloved name or definition? Do we demand? No. We give only. And in giving, we find all. So from the beginning of our human search, we approach by giving, we hesitate by gaining. And as we give more, we grow more. And these little interludes of false security are hours of sleep and rest along the road. Because it is through the sharing, the giving, the renouncing, that we serve the beloved. And finally, through all giving, become one with the all giver. It is hard to say these things, but perchance something of what we mean will filter through. And you can understand why, in mysticism and in the yoga, particularly happy, particularly bhakti yoga, we have a tremendous emphasis upon the final act of union, which is the individual, who finally gives the last having given all that he has, in the sense not of material things, but in the sense of proprietorship over things. Having given all that he has, there's only one thing to give, and that is all that he is. And in giving of that, he makes the final offering, which is acceptable to the beloved. And in this action, proves that he is the true seeker and the true lover. And by having demonstrated and proved this, moves magnificently and serenely into this great thousand-petal flower of infinite love, and vanishes as a light amidst the great light of the cosmic heart. These are the symbols. You must read them and understand them according to your own heart and according to your own souls.